On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Michael Flannery, author of Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life.
Let me throw out one more final quote from Jerry Coyne, and that's this. So when I'm giving the evidence for evolution based on the distribution of plants and animals, that all came from Darwin. None of that came from Wallace. We've kind of handled that so convincingly that I don't know that we need to just have you regurgitate the same thing. But I guess I'd use it as a bridge to this other thing is, how the heck can he say this kind of stuff? And why does he say this stuff, which is so obviously false and incorrect? What's the real agenda going on here?
I actually think that it just doesn't serve his purpose, which his overriding purpose was really, in my opinion, as far as I could tell, when you look at the his book, you know, Why Evolution is True, one of the things he's really writing against is intelligent design, and to bring Wallace into the picture becomes problematic.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have a short follow-up interview with Professor Michael Flannery from the University of Alabama, Birmingham, author of Alfred Russel Wallace, A Rediscovered Life. Now, you'll recall that at the end of the last episode of Skeptico, I told you I was going to do this interview because when we were talking to Dr. Jerry Coyne during the last interview, he had a number of things to say about this relationship between Darwin and Wallace, and in particular about whether or not Alfred Russel Wallace ever connected biogeography to evolution. Now, this sounds like a little bit of inside baseball and detail-oriented stuff that you may not care about in the bigger picture of science, but it turns out to be pretty central to this culture war debate surrounding the theory of evolution. Here's my interview with Professor Michael Flannery. So I've managed to get Professor Mike Flannery on the phone here, and Professor Flannery was nice enough to actually review the interview that we had with Jerry Coyne, and I sent it to him. And because I thought there were some kind of direct points about the Darwin versus Wallace thing that he certainly knows a lot better than I do, I thought we'd have Professor Flannery back on here. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Sure.
So just a couple of quick points here. I feel, first of all, that we have to frame this up. I mean, Dr. Jerry Coyne says, where was I wrong? You tell me where I was wrong. So I feel we have to oblige Dr. Coyne in that regard. And where I wanted to start, because I think he describes you as not a Wallace scholar, but as an intelligent design creationist. And, you know, I think when someone does that, which he does, and kind of slips into this other mode, that's not really at all even scientific. I resist even calling him a biologist, although he is trained and he has a PhD in biology. He's just purely coming at it from an atheist perspective. He's calling you a creationist. I mean, it's funny to me because when we started our discussion, your interview on Skeptico, we kind of joked about how, you know, I asked you, how many dinosaurs fit in Noah's Ark, you know? And we're kidding
right.
about how all these discussions just quickly degrade into these silly kind of attacks. And yet, here he is with the creationist thing. I mean, what did you think when you first heard that?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a when you don't have a real point to make. Sometimes the only point you can make is the ad hominem argument. You know, you attack the person rather than the idea. The very first thing I thought is, well, I mean, I've written a book about Alfred Russel Wallace. Whatever else may be said for it, the book should stand or fall on its own merit.
Let's kind of go over a little bit, because I think you, as demonstrated in your book and your interview with me, have an extensive knowledge of not just Wallace, but of all many of the Darwin scholars, Darwin biographers. I mean, you impress me as someone who's quite well-read and published on this topic. So to call you a Wallace scholar, I think, is pretty accurate.
Well, I thank you. I think the book has a real contribution to make, and I've spent a considerable amount of time studying over the past, I'd say 4 or 5 years, Alfred Russel Wallace. And if you look at the book, Alfred Russel Wallace, Rediscovered Life, it has well over 200 references in it, and it's thoroughly documented. And again, I would just say, I believe the book will stand on its own merits.
I think it will too. So let's get to some of the specifics where we can point out some questionable areas in Dr. Coyne's presentation. These are direct quotes. Here's quote number one. Wallace did not use biogeography as evidence of evolution. I mean, never.
Yeah, well, that's actually, in my written reply that you so kindly allowed me to present, and I assume we'll post. That's the specific, I think it goes to the essential heart of the matter of my disagreement with Dr. Coyne. He seems to really be unfamiliar with Wallace's body of writing on that topic. And as I point out, Wallace himself actually pointed out that this is not just a matter of applying some arbitrary divisions of the earth that might be useful to the zoologist, but in fact, it's a fundamental problem with the theory of evolution. And his two-volume work on the geographical distribution of animals, which he published in 1876, was written specifically to address that. Well, now, if that's not using biogeography as evidence for evolution, I mean, I don't know what it is. Let's be quite clear that Wallace's reputation as a biogeographer extends beyond the seminal work in that field, and that's the one I just mentioned. His work dates back to 1852.
Give us that date again. Give us that date again, because another quote from Dr. Coyne is, Wallace never made an argument until much after Darwin, and later he says 17 years after 1859. So,
well, he's referring to the geographical distribution of animals, which is the magnum opus in the field. There's no doubt about it. But actually, the very first paper, it was actually a work that Wallace read before the Zoological Society of London. He actually read it in December of 1852, was a paper called On the Monkeys of the Amazon. And he was then just beginning to be looking at geographical distributions of various species. And then, of course, a much more important work. This is 1852, so this is well before 1859, the first edition of Origin of Species, okay? But then in 1855, he writes, this was during the rainy season, and he was on the island of Sarawak, and he writes a paper called On the Law Which Has Regulated the Introduction of New Species, and that actually appeared in the annals and magazines of natural history. It appeared in September of 1855. And he actually applied the geographical distribution of animals in the Malay Archipelago, which is where he had been spending a considerable amount of his time, in fact, would spend a total of 8 years there. He was applying the geographical distribution of animals in that region to evolution.
So we have him reading a paper in 52.
Right.
Publishing a paper in 55. This is even before the Origin of Species. But let's get to Coyne's exact point. Wallace never made an argument until much after Darwin. So he's saying not until 17 years after, when he publishes his two-volume work. He never made the argument that biogeography itself is evidence for evolution. Where do we have evidence, like you presented in your written paper that we'll publish, that not only did he make the case before then, but others acknowledge that his writings were very influential in this area?
Well, sure, absolutely. The famous paleontologist and geologist, Henry Fairfield Osborne, for example, I mean, he's sort of an icon in the field. He referred to, and this is often called the Sarawak Law paper, the paper I mentioned that he wrote from the island of Sarawak. He referred to it as, and this is a quote actually, a very strong argument for the theory of descent and a bold declaration from a strong and fearless evolutionist.
Okay, so he's being called a strong and fearless evolutionist in this paper that was published in 55 before the Origin of Species. So he's recognized among all his contemporaries as being just crucial, and I would even go to say preeminent in terms of his understanding of the role of biogeography.
And actually, if you'd like, sort of an icing on the cake reference, Ian McCallum, who has written a pretty good book recently called Darwin's Armada, which is a nice summary of the various leaders in the field of evolution. It covers Huxley, it covers Hooker, Wallace, and then, of course, also Darwin. But McCallum actually refers to this Sarawak Law paper as the first ever British scientific paper to claim that animals had descended from a common ancestor and then produced closely similar variations which evolved into distinct species. Now, that's what McCallum says, and he's referring again to the Sarawak Law paper, which used geographical distribution as an essential part of his argument.
So when Coyne says that, quote unquote, Wallace basically used Darwin's ideas in his later book, what we really have is kind of the exact opposite of that, right? So we have them both exploring this idea, but the first one to publish on this area in terms of biogeography and evolution is clearly Wallace, correct?
Well, I mean, and that's why, you know, I think you even made reference to the president of the International Biogeography Society, who actually referred to him as the father of biogeography. Now, Dr. Coyne wants to say that, you know, he acknowledges that Wallace is the father of biogeography, but then he sort of like steps back and says, well, but he wasn't using it to explain evolution, which seems like a non sequitur to me. But the reason they call Wallace the father of biogeography is not just for his geographical distribution of animals, but for that whole body of writing that I just alluded to.
Great. Well, I think you've kind of squashed this whole thing, but let me throw out one more final quote from Jerry Coyne, and that's this. So when I'm giving the evidence for evolution based on the distribution of plants and animals, that all came from Darwin. None of that came from Wallace. I mean, I guess we've kind of handled that so convincingly that I don't know that we need to just have you regurgitate the same thing. But I guess I'd use it as a bridge to this other thing is, how the heck can he say this kind of stuff? And why does he say this stuff, which is so obviously false and incorrect? What's the real agenda going on here?
Well, my guess is this, that he is either just unfamiliar with Wallace's work, although it's kind of hard to believe that for anybody that's been in the field this as long as he has would certainly probably be aware of the body of work that Wallace contributed. I actually think that it just doesn't serve his purpose, which his overriding purpose was really, in my opinion, as far as I could tell, when you look at his book, you know, Why Evolution is True, one of the things he's really writing against is intelligent design, and to bring Wallace into the picture becomes problematic for him, because Wallace himself came to view, particularly in his later years, evolution as being guided. And it's what I call, in my book, intelligent evolution. Yes, there's common descent, but it is detectably designed and guided.
So, but hold on, Mike. I mean, we know why that matters so much, because it's such a hot cultural war debate. But inside of this narrow discussion, as the way we framed it up, how can that possibly matter? Why should that matter? I mean, you've just presented clear evidence of a misrepresentation of the facts. That's my opinion. Those are my words, not yours, so I don't want to hang you on that. But why should that? That should not matter when we're just talking about history, when we're talking about reading what others, scholars, what you and other scholars have written. Can't we just cut through that and read what they've really have said?
Well, I would hope so. And the idea behind history is to get a full picture of the past. And one of the reasons I wrote the Wallace book was to really, give a fuller picture of the breadth of contributions that Wallace made, not only in various aspects of evolution, but how, in many ways, the kind of intelligent evolutionary scenario that Wallace actually sketched out has a tremendous impact in, as you put it, in the ongoing contemporary debate today. So I would like to think that we would take a full look at that picture. That's what history is all about. That's one of the benefits of having a historical understanding, and not telling a partial story or sort of a one-sided story. But Wallace has always, in fact, even the title to Michael Shermer's book, In Darwin's Shadow. I mean, Wallace has been struggling against Darwin's shadow, since his death in 1913. So, again, the idea behind my book was to shed a little light on Wallace. And in my opinion, Jerry Coyne's book, all it does is cast a darker shadow on something that we're trying to understand a little better.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks for jumping in here and clearing up a couple of those details on the Wallace versus Darwin understanding of history there. Thanks a lot.
Okay, you're welcome, Alex.
Thanks again to Mike Flannery for joining me today on Skeptico. I've also published the written response that Professor Flannery did, and that's on the website. It's a link right below the show notes. Please give that a read. Very interesting stuff there. And I'm also going to post in the forum an interesting email exchange I had with Roy Davies, author of The Darwin Conspiracy. Interesting book from someone who's looked extensively at some of these Darwin-Wallace issues. You know, one thing to add on this debate issue between Dr. Jerry Coyne and myself in the last episode of Skeptico is, I know I came down on Dr. Coyne pretty hard at the end of that last show, but I think there's so many scientific points that were laid out there that were just left unaddressed that I felt like those needed to be brought to the table. And I'd go one step further and say, you know, I'd love to have a follow-up debate with Dr. Coyne. Anytime, any place, if he doesn't like the format or if he doesn't like me hosting the debate, I'm sure we could find any number of skeptical podcasts that would be willing to host such a debate. The important thing is that these scientific issues be debated. And since the central argument from Jerry was that he wasn't able to adequately prepare for the last debate we have, I think that should be easily resolved just by time. I mean, if we were able to get back together, I think there should be no excuse for him not responding to, for example, the self-directed neuroplasticity claim of Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, which we all agree seems to be central to the question of evolution, or whether or not quantum effects have ever been observed in biological systems. That's another question we could debate. Or whether quantum effects have anything to say about materialism. That's one of the other topics we had. So there's any number of topics that we could follow up on in a debate if Dr. Coyne is willing to do that. So we'll wait and see what his response is on that. Of course, if you'd like more information about this show, any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find there a link to our forum. We discussed the last show at length, and you can go in there and read what various skeptics as well as I guess, proponents have to say. And there's also a Facebook link, a comment section, and a direct email link to me there on our website. Well, that's going to do it for today. I have this accelerated publishing schedule of every week that is going to continue for a few more weeks. So I hope you can keep up with it. I have a lot of Skeptico coming at you here, but I hope you're enjoying it. That's going to do it for today. Take care. Bye for now.